bankers who had this capital. By 1904, more than 1,000 railroad lines had been consolidated into 6 great combinations, each allied with either Morgan or Rockefeller interests. As Cochrane and Miller say, the imperial leader of the new oligarchy was the House of Morgan. In its operations, it was ably assisted by the First National Bank of New York, directed by George F. Baker, and the National City Bank of New York, presided over by James Stillman, agent of the Rockefeller interests. Among them, these three men and their financial associates occupied 341 directorships in 112 great corporations. The total resources of these corporations in 1912 was $22,245,000,000, more than the assessed value of all property in the 22 states and territories west of the Mississippi River. Morgan had always wanted regularity, stability, predictability. An associate of his said in 1901, "With a man like Mr. Morgan at the head of a great industry, as against the old plan of many diverse interests in it, production would become more regular, labor would be more steadily employed at better wages, and panics caused by overproduction would become a thing of the past." But even Morgan and his associates were not in complete control of such a system. In 1907, there was a panic, financial collapse, and crisis. True, the very big businesses were not hurt. But profits after 1907 were not as high as capitalists wanted. Industry was not expanding as fast as it might, and industrialists began to look for ways to cut costs. One way was Taylorism. Frederick W. Taylor had been a steel company foreman who closely analyzed every job in the mill and worked out a system of finely detailed division of labor, increased mechanization and piecework wage systems to increase production and profits. In 1911, he published a book on scientific management that became powerfully influential in the business world. Now, management could control every detail of the workers' energy and time in the factory. As Harry Braverman said, Labor and Monopoly Capital, the purpose of Taylorism was to make workers interchangeable, able to do the simple tasks that the new division of labor required, like standard parts divested of individuality and humanity, bought and sold as commodities. It was a system well fitted for the new auto industry. In 1909, Ford sold 10,607 autos. In 1913, 168,000. In 1914, 248,000, 45% of all autos produced. The profit? $30 million. With immigrants a larger proportion of the labor force, in the Carnegie plants of Allegheny County in 1907, of the 14,359 common laborers, 11,694 were Eastern Europeans. Taylorism, with its simplified, unskilled jobs, became more feasible. In New York City, the new immigrants went to work in the sweatshops. The poet Edwin Markham wrote in Cosmopolitan magazine, January 1907, "In unaired rooms, mothers and fathers sew by day and by night. Those in the home sweatshop must work cheaper than those in the factory sweatshops. And the children are called in from play to drive and drudge beside their elders. All the year in New York and in other cities, you may watch children radiating to and from such pitiful homes. Nearly any hour on the east side of New York City, you can see them. Pallid boy or spindling girl, their faces dulled, their backs bent under a heavy load of garments piled on head and shoulders, the muscles of the whole frame in a long strain. Is it not a cruel civilization that allows little hearts and little shoulders to strain under these grown-up responsibilities? While in the same city, a pet cur is jeweled and pampered and aired on a fine lady's velvet lap on the beautiful boulevards?" The city became a battlefield. On August 10, 1905, the New York Tribune reported that a strike at Fetterman's Bakery on the Lower East Side led to violence when Fetterman used scab labor to continue producing. Strikers or their sympathizers wrecked the bake shop of Philip Fetterman at No. 183 Orchard Street early last night amid scenes of the most tumultuous excitement. Policemen smashed heads right and left with their nightsticks after two of their number had been roughly dealt with by the mob. There were 500 garment factories in New York. A woman later recalled the conditions of work. Dangerously broken stairways, windows few and so dirty, the wooden floors that were swept once a year, hardly any other light but the gas jets burning by day and by night, the filthy, malodorous lavatory in the dark hall, no fresh drinking water, mice and roaches. During the winter months, how we suffered from the cold. In the summer, we suffered from the heat. In these disease-breeding holes, we, the youngsters, together with the men and women, toiled from 70 and 80 hours a week, Saturdays and Sundays included. A sign would go up on Saturday afternoon, "If you don't come in on Sunday, you need not come in on Monday." Children's dreams of a day off shattered. We wept, for after all, we were only children. At the Triangle Shirtwaist Company, in the winter of 1909, women organized and decided to strike. Soon they were walking the picket line in the cold, knowing they could not win while the other factories were operating. A mass meeting was called of workers in the other shops, and Clara Lemlich, in her teens, an eloquent speaker, still bearing the signs of her recent beating on the picket line, stood up. "I offer a resolution that a general strike be declared now." The meeting went wild. They voted to strike. Pauline Newman, one of the strikers, recalled years later the beginning of the general strike. "Thousands upon thousands left the factories from every side, all of them walking down toward Union Square. It was November. The cold winter was just around the corner. We had no fur coats to keep warm, and yet there was the spirit that led us on and on until we got to some hall. I can see the young people, mostly women, walking down and not caring what might happen. The hunger, cold, loneliness. They just didn't care on that particular day. That was their day." The union had hoped 3,000 would join the strike. 20,000 walked out. Every day, 1,000 new members joined the union, the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union, which before this had few women. Colored women were active in the strike, which went on through the winter, against police, against scabs, against arrests and prison. In more than 300 shops, workers won their demands. Women now became officials in the union. Pauline Newman again. "We tried to educate ourselves. I would invite the girls to my rooms, and we took turns reading poetry in English to improve our understanding of the language. One of my favorites was Thomas Hood's Song of the Shirt, and another, Percy Bysshe Shelley's Mask of Anarchy. Rise like lions after slumber, in unvanquishable number. Shake your chains to earth like dew, which in sleep had fallen on you. Ye are many, they are few." The conditions in the factories did not change much. On the afternoon of March 25, 1911, a fire at the Triangle Shirtwaist Company that began in a rag bin swept through the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors, too high for fire ladders to reach. The fire chief of New York had said that his ladders could reach only to the 7th floor. But half of New York's 500,000 workers spent all day, perhaps 12 hours, above the 7th floor. The laws said factory doors had to open outward, but at the Triangle Company, the doors opened in. The law said the doors could not be locked during working hours, but at the Triangle Company, doors were usually locked so the company could keep track of the employees. And so, trapped, The young women were burned to death at their work tables, or jammed against the locked exit door, or leaped to their deaths down the elevator shafts. The New York World reported, "Screaming men and women and boys and girls crowded out on the many window ledges and threw themselves into the streets far below. They jumped with their clothing ablaze. The hair of some of the girls streamed up aflame as they leaped. Thud after thud sounded on the pavements. It is a ghastly fact that on both the Green Street and Washington Place sides of the building there grew mounds of the dead and dying. From opposite windows, spectators saw again and again pitiable companionships formed in the instant of death, girls who placed their arms around each other as they leaped. When it was over, 146 triangle workers, mostly women, were burned or crushed to death. There was a memorial parade down Broadway, and 100,000 marched. There were more fires, and accidents, and sickness. In the year 1904, 27,000 workers were killed on the job, in manufacturing, transport, and agriculture. In 1 year, 50,000 accidents took place in New York factories alone. Hat and cap makers were getting respiratory diseases. Quarrymen were inhaling deadly chemicals. Lithographic printers were getting arsenic poisoning. A New York State Factory Investigation Commission reported in 1912, "Sadie is an intelligent, neat, clean girl who has worked from the time she got her working papers in embroidery factories. In her work, she was accustomed to use a white powder, chalk or talcum was usual, which was brushed over the perforated designs and thus transferred to the cloth. The design was easily brushed off when made of chalk or of talcum. Her last employer therefore commenced using white lead powder mixed with rosin, which cheapened the work as the powder could not be rubbed off and necessitate restamping. None of the girls knew of the change in powder, nor of the danger in its use. Sadie had been a very strong, healthy girl, good appetite and color. She began to be unable to eat. Her hands and feet swelled. She lost the use of one hand. Her teeth and gums were blue. When she finally had to stop work after being treated for months for stomach trouble, her physician advised her to go to a hospital. There, the examination revealed the fact that she had lead poisoning." According to a report of the Commission on Industrial Relations in 1914, 35,000 workers were killed in industrial accidents and 700,000 injured. That year, the income of 44 families making $1 million or more equaled the total income of 100,000 families earning $500 a year. The record shows an exchange between Commissioner Harris Weinstock of the Commission on Industrial Relations and President John Osgood, head of a Colorado coal company controlled by the Rockefellers. Weinstock: "If a worker loses his life, are his dependents compensated in any way?" Osgood: "Not necessarily. In some cases they are, and in some cases not." Weinstock: "If he is crippled for life, is there any compensation?" Osgood: "No, sir, there is none." Weinstock: "Then the whole burden is thrown directly upon their shoulders." Osgood: "Yes, sir." Weinstock: "The industry bears none of it?" Osgood: "Nope, the industry bears none of it." Unionization was growing. Shortly after the turn of the century, there were 2 million members of labor unions, 1 in 14 workers, 80% of them in the American Federation of Labor. The AFL was an exclusive union, almost all male, almost all white, almost all skilled workers. Although the number of women workers kept growing, it doubled from 4 million in 1890 to 8 million in 1910, and women were one-fifth of the labor force. Only 1 in 100 belonged to a union. Black workers in 1910 made one-third of the earnings of white workers. Although Samuel Gompers, head of the AFL, would make speeches about its belief in equal opportunity, the Negro was excluded from most AFL unions. Gompers kept saying he did not want to interfere with the internal affairs of the South. "I regard the race problem as one with which you people of the Southland will have to deal, without the interference, too, of meddlers from the outside." In the reality of struggle, rank-and-file workers overcame these separations from time to time. Foner quotes Mary McDowell's account of the formation of a woman's union in the Chicago stockyards. "It was a dramatic occasion on that evening when an Irish girl at the door called out, 'A colored sister asks admission. What shall I do with her?' And the answer came back from the Irish young woman on the chair, 'Admit her, of course, and let all of you give her a hearty welcome.'" In New Orleans in 1907, a general strike on the levees involving 10,000 workers, longshoremen, teamsters, freight handlers, black and white, lasted 20 days. The head of the Negro longshoremen, E.S. Swan, said, "The whites and Negroes were never before so strongly cemented in a common bond, and in my 39 years of experience on the levee, I never saw such solidarity. In all the previous strikes, the Negro was used against the white man, but that condition is now past, and both races are standing together for their common interests." There were exceptions. In general, the Negro was kept out of the trade union movement. W.E.B. Du Bois wrote in 1913, "The net result of all this has been to convince the American Negro that his greatest enemy is not the employer who robs him, but his fellow white working man." Racism was practical for the AFL. The exclusion of women and foreigners was also practical. These were mostly unskilled workers, and the AFL, confined mostly to skilled workers, was based on the philosophy of business unionism. In fact, the chief official of each AFL union was called the business agent. Trying to match the monopoly of production by the employer with the monopoly of workers by the union. In this way, it won better conditions for some workers and left most workers out. AFL officials drew large salaries, hobnobbed with employers, even moved in high society. A press dispatch from Atlantic City, New Jersey, the fashionable seaside resort in the summer of 1910. "Engaged in a game of bathing suit baseball with President Sam Gompers, Secretary Frank Morrison, and other leaders of the AFL on the beach this morning, John Mitchell, former head of the Mine Workers Union, lost a $1,000 diamond ring presented to him by his admirers after the settlement of the big Pennsylvania coal strike. Captain George Burke, a veteran lifeguard, found the ring, whereupon Mitchell peeled a $100 bill from a roll he carried in his pocket and handed it to the captain as a reward for his find." The well-paid leaders of the AFL were protected from criticism by tightly controlled meetings and by goon squads, hired toughs, originally used against strikebreakers, but after a while used to intimidate and beat up opponents inside the union. In this situation, terrible conditions of labor, exclusivity in union organization, working people wanting radical change, seeing the root of misery in the capitalist system, moved toward a new kind of labor union. One morning in June 1905, there met in a hall in Chicago a convention of 200 socialists, anarchists, and radical trade unionists from all over the United States. They were forming the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World. Big Bill Haywood, a leader of the Western Federation of Miners, recalled in his autobiography that he picked up a piece of board that lay on the platform and used it for a gavel to open the convention. "Fellow workers, this is the Continental Congress of the Working Class. We are here to confederate the workers of this country into a working class movement that shall have for its purpose the emancipation of the working class from the slave bondage of capitalism. The aims and objects of this organization shall be to put the working class in possession of the economic power, the means of life, in control of the machinery of production and distribution without regard to the capitalist masters." On the speakers platform with Haywood were Eugene Debs, leader of the Socialist Party, and Mother Mary Jones, a 75-year-old white-haired woman who was an organizer for the United Mine Workers of America. The convention drew up a constitution whose preamble said, "The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until all the toilers come together on the political as well as on the industrial field, and take and hold that which they produce by their labor. Through an economic organization of the working class, without affiliation with any political party." One of the IWW pamphlets explained why it broke with the AFL idea of craft unions. "The Directory of Unions of Chicago shows in 1903 a total of 56 different unions in the packing houses, divided up still more in 14 different national trades unions of the American Federation of Labor. What a horrible example of an army divided against itself in the face of a strong combination of employers." The IWW, or Wobblies as they came to be called for reasons not really clear, aimed at organizing all workers in any industry into one big union, undivided by sex, race, or skills. They argued against making contracts with the employer, because this had so often prevented workers from striking on their own or in sympathy with other strikers, and thus turned union people into strikebreakers. Negotiations by leaders for contracts replaced continuous struggle by the rank and file, the Wobblies believed. They spoke of direct action. Direct action means industrial action directly by, for, and of the workers themselves, without the treacherous aid of labor misleaders or scheming politicians. A strike that is initiated, controlled, and settled by the workers directly affected is direct action. Direct action is industrial democracy. One IWW pamphlet said, "Shall I tell you what direct action means? The worker on the job shall tell the boss when and where he shall work, how long, and for what wages, and under what conditions." The IWW people were militant, courageous. Despite a reputation given them by the press, they did not believe in initiating violence, but did fight back when attacked. In McKees Rocks, Pennsylvania, they led a strike of 6,000 workers in 1909 against an affiliate of the U.S. Steel Company, defied state troopers, and battled with them. They promised to take a trooper's life for every worker killed. In one gun battle, 4 strikers and 3 troopers were killed, and managed to keep picketing the factories until the strike was won. The IWW saw beyond strikes. "Strikes are mere incidents in the class war. They are tests of strength, periodical drills in the course of which the workers train themselves for concerted action. This training is most necessary to prepare the masses for the final catastrophe. The general strike which will complete the expropriation of the employers." The idea of anarcho-syndicalism was developing strongly in Spain and Italy and France at this time, that the workers would take power, not by seizing the state machinery in an armed rebellion, but by bringing the economic system to a halt in a general strike, then taking it over to use for the good of all. IWW organizer Joseph Etter said, "If the workers of the world want to win, all they have to do is recognize their own solidarity. They have nothing to do but fold their arms and the world will stop. The workers are more powerful with their hands in their pockets than all the property of the capitalists." It was an immensely powerful idea. In the 10 exciting years after its birth, the IWW became a threat to the capitalist class, exactly when capitalist growth was enormous and profits huge. The IWW never had more than 5 to 10,000 enrolled members at any one time. People came and went, and perhaps 100,000 were members at one time or another. But their energy, their persistence, their inspiration to others, their ability to mobilize thousands at one place, one time, made them an influence on the country far beyond their numbers. They traveled everywhere. Many were unemployed or migrant workers. They organized, wrote, spoke, sang, spread their message and their spirit. They were attacked with all the weapons the system could put together. The newspapers, the courts, the police, the army, mob violence. Local authorities passed laws to stop them from speaking. The IWW defied these laws. In Missoula, Montana, a lumber and mining area, hundreds of Wobblies arrived by boxcar after some had been prevented from speaking. They were arrested one after another until they clogged the jails and the courts, and finally forced the town to repeal its anti-speech ordinance. In Spokane, Washington, in 1909, an ordinance was passed to stop street meetings, and an IWW organizer who insisted on speaking was arrested. Thousands of Wobblies marched into the center of town to speak. One by one, they spoke and were arrested, until 600 were in jail. Jail conditions were brutal, and several men died in their cells, but the IWW won the right to speak. In Fresno, California, in 1911, there was another free speech fight. The San Francisco Call commented, "It is one of those strange situations which crop up suddenly and are hard to understand. Some thousands of men, whose business it is to work with their hands, tramping and stealing rides, suffering hardships and facing dangers, to get into jail." In jail they sang, they shouted, they made speeches through the bars to groups that gathered outside the prison. As Joyce Kornbluh reports in her remarkable collection of IWW documents, Rebel Voices, "They took turns lecturing about the class struggle and leading the singing of Wobbly songs. When they refused to stop, the jailer sent for fire department trucks and ordered the fire hoses turned full force on the prisoners. The men used their mattresses as shields, and quiet was only restored when the icy water reached knee-high in the cells." When city officials heard that thousands more were planning to come into town, they lifted the ban on street speaking and released the prisoners in small groups. That same year, in Aberdeen, Washington, once again laws against free speech, arrests, prison, and, unexpectedly, victory. One of the men arrested, Stumpy Payne, a carpenter, farmhand, editor of an IWW newspaper, wrote about the experience. "Here they were, 18 men in the vigor of life, most of whom came long distances through snow and hostile towns by beating their way, penniless and hungry, into a place where a jail sentence was the gentlest treatment that could be expected, and where many had already been driven into the swamps and beaten nearly to death. Yet here they were, laughing with boyish glee at tragic things that to them were jokes. But what was the motive behind the actions of these men? Why were they here? Is the call of brotherhood in the human race greater than any fear or discomfort, despite the efforts of the masters of life for 6,000 years to root out that call of brotherhood from our minds?" In San Diego, Jack White, a Wobbly arrested in a free speech fight in 1912, sentenced to 6 months in the county jail on a bread-and-water diet, was asked if he had anything to say to the court. A stenographer recorded what he said. "The prosecuting attorney, in his plead to the jury, accused me of saying on a public platform at a public meeting, 'To hell with the courts, we know what justice is.' He told a great truth when he lied, for if he had searched the innermost recesses of my mind, he could have found that thought, never expressed by me before, but which I express now. To hell with your courts. I know what justice is. For I have sat in your courtroom day after day and have seen members of my class pass before this, the so-called bar of justice. I have seen you, Judge Sloan, and others of your kind, send them to prison because they dare to infringe upon the sacred rights of property. You have become blind and deaf to the rights of man to pursue life and happiness, and you have crushed those rights so that the sacred right of property shall be preserved. Then you tell me to respect the law? I do not. I did violate the law, as I will violate every one of your laws, and still come before you and say, to hell with the courts. The prosecutor lied, but I will accept his lie as a truth and say again, so that you, Judge Sloan, may not be mistaken as to my attitude. To hell with your courts. I know what justice is. There were also beatings, tarrings, and featherings, defeats. One IWW member, John Stone, tells of being released from the jail at San Diego at midnight with another IWW man and forced into an automobile. We were taken out of the city, about 20 miles where the machine stopped. A man in the rear struck me with a blackjack several times on the head and shoulders. The other man then struck me on the mouth with his fist. The men in the rear then sprang around and kicked me in the stomach. I then started to run away and heard a bullet go past me. I stopped. In the morning, I examined Joe Marco's condition and found that the back of his head had been split open. In 1916, in Everett, Washington, a boatload of Wobblies was fired on by 200 armed vigilantes gathered by the sheriff, and 5 Wobblies were shot to death, 31 wounded. 2 of the vigilantes were killed, 19 wounded. The following year, the year the United States entered World War I, vigilantes in Montana seized IWW organizer Frank Little, tortured him, and hanged him, leaving his body dangling from a railroad trestle. Joe Hill, an IWW organizer, wrote dozens of songs, biting, funny, class-conscious, inspiring, that appeared in IWW publications and in its Little Red Songbook. He became a legend in his time and after. His song, The Preacher and the Slave, had a favorite IWW target, the church. Long-haired preachers come out every night, try to tell you what's wrong and what's right, but when asked how about something to eat, they'll answer with voices so sweet, you will eat by and by, in that glorious land above the sky. Work and pray, live on bay, you'll get pie in the sky when you die. His song Rebel Girl was inspired by the strike of women at the textile mills in Lawrence, Massachusetts, and especially by the IWW leader of that strike, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. They are women of many descriptions in this queer world, as everyone knows. Some are living in beautiful mansions and are wearing the finest of clothes. There are blue-blooded queens and princesses who have charms made of diamonds and pearl. But the only and thoroughbred lady is the rebel girl. In November 1915, Joe Hill was accused of killing a grocer in Salt Lake City, Utah, in a robbery. There was no direct evidence presented to the court that he had committed the murder, but there were enough pieces of evidence to persuade a jury to find him guilty. The case became known throughout the world, and 10,000 letters went to the governor in protest. But with machine guns guarding the entrance to the prison, Joe Hill was executed by a firing squad. He had written Bill Haywood just before this, "Don't waste any time in mourning. Organize." The IWW became involved in a set of dramatic events in Lawrence, Massachusetts in the year 1912, where the American Woolen Company owned 4 mills. The workforce were immigrant families, Portuguese, French-Canadian, English, Irish, Russian, Italian, Syrian, Lithuanian, German, Polish, Belgian, who lived in crowded, flammable wooden tenements. The average wage was $8.76 a week. A woman physician in Lawrence, Dr. Elizabeth Shapley, wrote, "A considerable number of the boys and girls die within the first 2 or 3 years after beginning work. 36 out of every 100 of all the men and women who work in the mill die before or by the time they are 25 years of age. It was in January, midwinter, when pay envelopes distributed to weavers at one of the mills, Polish women, showed that their wages, already too low to feed their families, had been reduced. They stopped their looms and walked out of the mill. The next day, 5,000 workers at another mill quit work, marched to still another mill, rushed the gates, shut off the power to the looms, and called on the other workers to leave. Soon, 10,000 workers were on strike. A telegram went to Joseph Etter, a 26-year-old Italian, an IWW leader in New York, to come to Lawrence to help conduct the strike. He came. A committee of 50 was set up, representing every nationality among the workers to make the important decisions. Less than 1,000 mill workers belonged to the IWW, but the AFL had ignored the unskilled workers, and so they turned to the IWW leadership in the strike. The IWW organized mass meetings and parades. The strikers had to supply food and fuel for 50,000 people. The entire population of Lawrence was 86,000. Soup kitchens were set up, and money began arriving from all over the country, from trade unions, IWW locals, socialist groups, individuals. The mayor called out the local militia. The governor ordered out the state police. A parade of strikers was attacked by police a few weeks after the strike began. This led to rioting all that day. In the evening, a striker, Anna Lopizzo, was shot and killed. Witnesses said a policeman did it, but the authorities arrested Joseph Etter and another IWW organizer who had come to Lawrence, a poet named Arturo Giovannitti. Neither was at the scene of the shooting, but the charge was that Joseph Etter and Arturo Giovannitti did incite, procure, and counsel or command the said person whose name is not known to commit the said murder. With Etter, head of the strike committee, in jail, Big Bill Haywood was called in to replace him. Other IWW organizers, including Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, came into Lawrence. Now there were 22 companies of militia and 2 troops of cavalry in the city. Martial law was declared, and citizens were forbidden to talk on the street. 36 strikers were arrested, many sentenced to a year in prison. On Tuesday, January 30th, a young Syrian striker, John Ramey, was bayoneted to death. But the strikers were still out, and the mills were not working. Etter said, "Bayonets cannot weave cloth." In February, the strikers began mass picketing, 7,000 to 10,000 pickets in an endless chain marching through the mill districts with white armbands, "Don't be a scab." But their food was running out and the children were hungry. It was proposed by the New York Call, a socialist newspaper, that the children of strikers be sent to sympathetic families in other cities to take care of them while the strike lasted. This had been done by strikers in Europe, never in the United States. But in 3 days, the Call got 400 letters offering to take children. The IWW and the Socialist Party began to organize the children's exodus, taking applications from families who wanted them, arranging medical exams for the youngsters. On February 10th, over 100 children aged 4 to 14 left Lawrence for New York City. They were greeted at Grand Central Station by 5,000 Italian socialists singing the Marseillaise and the Internationale. The following week, another 100 children came to New York, and 35 to Barre, Vermont. It was becoming clear, if the children were taken care of, the strikers could stay out, for their spirit was high. The city officials in Lawrence, citing a statute on child neglect, said no more children would be permitted to leave Lawrence. Despite the city edict, a group of 40 children assembled on February 24th to go to Philadelphia. The railroad station was filled with police, and the scene that followed was described to congressmen by a member of the Women's Committee of Philadelphia. When the time approached to depart, The children arranged in a long line, two by two, in orderly procession, with their parents near at hand, were about to make their way to the train when the police closed in on us with their clubs, beating right and left, with no thought of children who were in the most desperate danger of being trampled to death. The mothers and children were thus hurled in a mass and bodily dragged to a military truck, and even then clubbed, irrespective of the cries of the panic-stricken women and children. A week after that, women returning from a meeting were surrounded by police and clubbed. One pregnant woman was carried unconscious to a hospital and gave birth to a dead child. Still, the strikers held out. "They are always marching and singing," reporter Mary Heaton Vorse wrote. "The tired, gray crowds ebbing and flowing perpetually into the mills had waked and opened their mouths to sing." The American Woolen Company decided to give in. It offered raises of 5 to 11%. The strikers insisted that the largest increases go to the lowest paid. Time and a quarter for overtime, and no discrimination against those who had struck. On March 14, 1912, 10,000 strikers gathered on the Lawrence Common, and with Bill Haywood presiding, voted to end the strike. Etter and Giovannitti went on trial. Support for them had been mounting all over the country. There were parades in New York and Boston. On September 30th, 15,000 Lawrence workers struck for 24 hours to show their support for the two men. After that, 2,000 of the most active strikers were fired, but the IWW threatened to call another strike, and they were put back. A jury found Etter and Giovannitti not guilty, and that afternoon, 10,000 people assembled in Lawrence to celebrate. The IWW took its slogan, One Big Union, seriously. Women, foreigners, black workers, the lowliest and most unskilled of workers, were included when a factory or mine was organized. When the Brotherhood of Timber Workers organized in Louisiana and invited Bill Haywood to speak to them in 1912, shortly after the Lawrence victory, he expressed surprise that no Negroes were at the meeting. He was told it was against the law to have interracial meetings in Louisiana. Haywood told the convention, "You work in the same mills together. Sometimes a black man and a white man chop down the same tree together. You are meeting in convention now to discuss the conditions under which you labor. Why not be sensible about this and call the Negroes into the convention? If it is against the law, this is one time when the law should be broken." Negroes were invited into the convention, which then voted to affiliate with the IWW. In 1900, there were 500,000 women office workers. In 1870, there had been 19,000. Women were switchboard operators, store workers, nurses. 500,000 were teachers. The teachers formed a teachers' league that fought against the automatic firing of women who became pregnant. The following rules for female teachers were posted by the school board of one town in Massachusetts. 1. Do not get married. 2. Do not leave town at any time without permission of the school board. 3. Do not keep company with men. 4. Be home between the hours of 8 p.m. and 6 a.m. 5. Do not loiter downtown in ice cream stores. 6. Do not smoke. 7. Do not get into a carriage with any man except your father or brother. 8. Do not dress in bright colors. 9. Do not dye your hair. 10. Do not wear any dress more than 2 inches above the ankle. The conditions of women working in a Milwaukee brewery were described by Mother Mary Jones, who worked there briefly in 1910. She was close to 80 at the time. Condemned to slave daily in the washroom in wet shoes and wet clothes, surrounded by foul-mouthed, brutal foremen, the poor girls work in the vile smell of sour beer, lifting cases of empty and full bottles weighing from 100 to 150 pounds. Rheumatism is one of the chronic ailments and is closely followed by consumption. The foreman even regulates the time the girls may stay in the toilet room. Many of the girls have no home nor parents and are forced to feed and clothe and shelter themselves on $3 a week. In the laundries, women organized. In 1909, the Handbook of the Women's Trade Union Industrial League wrote about women in steam laundries. How would you like to iron a shirt a minute? Think of standing at a mangle just above the washroom with the hot steam pouring up through the floor for 10, 12, 14, and sometimes 17 hours a day. Sometimes the floors are made of cement, and then it seems as though one were standing on hot coals and the workers are dripping with perspiration. They are breathing air laden with particles of soda, ammonia, and other chemicals. The Laundry Workers Union, in one city, reduced this long day to 9 hours and has increased the wages 50%. Labor struggles could make things better, but the country's resources remained in the hands of powerful corporations whose motive was profit, whose power commanded the government of the United States. There was an idea in the air becoming clearer and stronger, an idea not just in the theories of Karl Marx, but in the dreams of writers and artists through the ages, that people might cooperatively use the treasures of the earth to make life better for everyone, not just a few. Around the turn of the century, strike struggles were multiplying. In the 1890s, there had been about 1,000 strikes a year. By 1904, there were 4,000 strikes a year. Law and military force again and again took the side of the rich. It was a time when hundreds of thousands of Americans began to think of socialism. Debs wrote in 1904, 3 years after the formation of the Socialist Party, "The pure and simple trades union of the past does not answer the requirements of today. The attempt of each trade to maintain its own independence, separately and apart from others, results in increasing jurisdictional entanglements, fruitful of dissension, strife, and ultimate disruption. The members of a trades union should be taught that the labor movement means more, infinitely more, than a paltry increase in wages and the strike necessary to secure it. That while it engages to do all that possibly can be done to better the working conditions of its members, its higher object is to overthrow the capitalist system of private ownership of the tools of labor, abolish wage slavery, and achieve the freedom of the whole working class and, in fact, of all mankind." What Debs accomplished was not in theory or analysis, but in expressing eloquently, passionately, what people were feeling. The writer Haywood Broun once quoted a fellow socialist speaking of Debs, "That old man with the burning eyes actually believes that there can be such a thing as the brotherhood of man. And that's not the funniest part of it. As long as he's around, I believe it myself." Eugene Debs had become a socialist while in jail in the Pullman strike. Now he was the spokesman of a party that made him its presidential candidate 5 times. The party at one time had 100,000 members and 1,200 office holders in 340 municipalities. Its main newspaper, Appeal to Reason, for which Debs wrote, had 500,000 subscribers, and there were many other socialist newspapers around the country, so that altogether perhaps 1 million people read the socialist press. Socialism moved out of the small circles of city immigrants, Jewish and German socialists speaking their own languages, and became American. The strongest socialist state organization was in Oklahoma, which in 1914 had 12,000 dues-paying members, more than New York State, and elected over 100 socialists to local office, including 6 to the Oklahoma State Legislature. There were 55 weekly socialist newspapers in Oklahoma, Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, and summer encampments that drew thousands of people. James Green describes these Southwest radicals in his book Grassroots Socialism as indebted homesteaders, migratory tenant farmers, coal miners and railroad workers, redbone lumberjacks from the piney woods, preachers and schoolteachers from the sunbaked prairies, village artisans and atheists, the unknown people who created the strongest regional socialist movement in United States history. Green continues, "The socialist movement was painstakingly organized by scores of former populists, militant miners, and blacklisted railroad workers who were assisted by a remarkable cadre of professional agitators and educators, and inspired by occasional visits from national figures like Eugene V. Debs and Mother Jones. This core of organizers grew to include indigenous dissenters, a much larger group of amateur agitators who canvassed the region selling newspapers, forming reading groups, organizing locals, and making soapbox speeches. There was almost a religious fervor to the movement, as in the eloquence of Debs. In 1906, after the imprisonment in Idaho of Bill Haywood and two other officers of the Western Federation of Miners on an apparently faked murder charge, Debs wrote a flaming article in The Appeal to Reason. Murder has been plotted and is about to be executed in the name and under the forms of law. It is a foul plot, a damnable conspiracy, a hellish outrage. If they attempt to murder Moyer, Haywood, and their brothers, 1 million revolutionists at least will meet them with guns. Capitalist courts never have done and never will do anything for the working class. A special revolutionary convention of the proletariat would be in order, and if extreme measures are required, a general strike could be ordered and industry paralyzed as a preliminary to a general uprising. If the plutocrats begin the program, we will end it." Theodore Roosevelt, after reading this, sent a copy to his Attorney General, W.H. Moody, with a note, "Is it possible to proceed against Debs and the proprietor of this paper criminally?" As the socialists became more successful at the polls, Debs got 900,000 votes in 1912, double what he had in 1908. And more concerned with increasing that appeal, they became more critical of IWW tactics of sabotage and violence, and in 1913 removed Bill Haywood from the Socialist Party Executive Committee, claiming he advocated violence, although some of Debs' writings were far more inflammatory. Women were active in the socialist movement, more as rank-and-file workers than as leaders, and sometimes as sharp critics of socialist policy. Helen Keller, for instance, the gifted, blind, mute, deaf woman with her extraordinary social vision, commented on the expulsion of Bill Haywood in a letter to the New York Call. "It is with the deepest regret that I have read the attacks upon Comrade Haywood. Such an ignoble strife between two factions which should be won, and that, too, at a most critical period in the struggle of the proletariat. What, are we to put difference of party tactics before the desperate needs of the workers, while countless women and children are breaking their hearts and ruining their bodies in long days of toil, we are fighting one another? Shame upon us!" Only 3% of the Socialist Party's members were women in 1904. At the National Convention that year, there were only 8 women delegates. But in a few years, local socialist women's organizations and a national magazine, Socialist Woman, began bringing more women into the party, so that by 1913, 15% of the membership was women. The editor of Socialist Woman, Josephine Conger Kaneko, insisted on the importance of separate groups for women. "In the separate organization, the most unsophisticated little woman may soon learn to preside over a meeting, to make motions, and to defend her stand with a little speech. After a year or two of this sort of practice, she is ready to work with the men. And there is a mighty difference between working with the men and simply sitting in obedient reverence under the shadow of their aggressive power." Socialist women were active in the feminist movement of the early 1990s. According to Kate Richards O'Hare, the socialist leader from Oklahoma, New York women socialists were superbly organized. During the 1915 campaign in New York for a referendum on women's suffrage, In one day, at the climax of the campaign, they distributed 60,000 English leaflets, 50,000 Yiddish leaflets, sold 2,500 one-cent books, and 1,500 five-cent books, put up 40,000 stickers, and held 100 meetings. But were there problems of women that went beyond politics and economics that would not be solved automatically by a socialist system? Once the economic base of sexual oppression was corrected, would equality follow? Battling for the vote or for anything less than revolutionary change, was that pointless? The argument became sharper as the women's movement of the early 20th century grew, as women spoke out more, organized, protested, paraded for the vote and for recognition as equals in every sphere, including sexual relations and marriage. Charlotte Perkins Gilman, whose writing emphasized the crucial question of economic equality between the sexes, wrote a poem called The Socialist and the Suffragist, ending with, "A lifted world lifts women up," the socialist explained. "You cannot lift the world at all while half of it is kept so small," the suffragist maintained. The world awoke and tartly spoke, "Your work is all the same. Work together or work apart, work each of you with all your heart, just get into the game." When Susan Anthony, at 80, went to hear Eugene Debs speak, 25 years before he had gone to hear her speak, and they had not met since, they clasped hands warmly, then had a brief exchange. She said, laughing, "Give us suffrage and we'll give you socialism." Debs replied, "Give us socialism, we'll give you suffrage." There were women who insisted on uniting the two aims of socialism and feminism, like Crystal Eastman, who imagined new ways of men and women living together and retaining their independence, different from traditional marriage. She was a socialist, but wrote once that a woman knows that the whole of woman's slavery is not summed up in the profit system, nor her complete emancipation assured by the downfall of capitalism. In the first 15 years of the 20th century, there were more women in the labor force, more with experience in labor struggles. Some middle-class women, conscious of women's oppression and wanting to do something, were going to college and becoming aware of themselves as not just housewives. The historian William Chaffee writes, Women and Equality, "Female college students were infused with a self-conscious sense of mission and a passionate commitment to improve the world. They became doctors, college professors, settlement house workers, businesswomen, lawyers, and architects. Spirited by an intense sense of purpose as well as camaraderie, they set a remarkable record of accomplishment in the face of overwhelming odds. Jane Addams, Grace and Edith Abbott, Alice Hamilton, Julia Lathrop, Florence Kelly, all came out of this pioneering generation and set the agenda of social reform for the first two decades of the 20th century. They were defying the culture of mass magazines, which were spreading the message of woman as companion, wife, homemaker. Some of these feminists married, some did not. All struggled with the problems of relations with men, like Margaret Sanger, pioneer of birth control education, who suffered a nervous breakdown inside an apparently happy but confining marriage. She had to leave husband and children to make a career for herself and feel whole again. Sanger had written in Woman and the New Race, "No woman can call herself free who does not own and control her own body. No woman can call herself free until she can choose conscientiously whether she will or will not be a mother." It was a complicated problem. Kate Richards O'Hare, for example, believed in the home, but thought socialism would make that better. When she ran for Congress in 1910 in Kansas City, she said, "I long for domestic life, home and children, with every fiber of my being. Socialism is needed to restore the home." On the other hand, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn wrote in her autobiography, Rebel Girl, A domestic life and possibly a large family had no attraction for me. I wanted to speak and write, to travel, to meet people, to see places, to organize for the IWW. I saw no reason why I, as a woman, should give up my work for this. While many women in this time were radicals, socialists, anarchists, an even larger number were involved in the campaign for suffrage, and the mass support for feminism came from them. Veterans of trade union struggles joined the